A1.
Number 16A.
Now we are still considering this divine infinite calculus. That is to consider how really every idea in being, because every idea in being is timeless and spaceless, must reflect all other ideas. See, we can never have an isolated idea, because an idea, as we have seen, is always universal. It's never at a certain point in time or at a certain place in space, but it's always infinite, and so always reflects each other idea. We have seen how, say, each synonymous term reflects each other synonymous term. Then we have seen how these seven synonymous terms reflect each of the four sides, and so we had the four orders. But we can also see how every idea reflects the four. And that is really very important in practice. I think the pith of a metaphysical treatment lies in this, that we see that every idea operates within the world, the Christ, Christianity, and science. And only that through this operation, really the idea has demonstrating power. You remember when we were considering the method of practice, how we would say that first we put away behind ourselves the problem. Don't look at it anymore. Then we turn to God and start with God. And that then, say, we would think in the line how God looks at the problem. And then, as we do that, God reveals to us a definite idea, the specific truth about the specific error. So the moment, say, the specific truth is revealed to us, then naturally we have to see that specific idea or specific truth is operating through the world, through the Christ and Christianity and science, because only through the four it demonstrates itself. For instance, let's see how an idea reflects the four. Say, in your treatment and your conscious communion with God, you begin to realize that the governing error is, say, action. And you get the true sense of action. Well, it's not enough to see that the specific truth is action, but then you begin to realize that this truth operates through the four. How? And then you... So, let's see how it operates through the four. First, the word. You begin to realize that action is mind, God. And so you begin to realize that whatever the problem may be of an organ or anything which is not acting properly or functioning properly, you begin to turn, the word is always that which turns to God. First to turn to God and see God is action. God is all the action there is. And so we turn not to the diseased organ that is not functioning properly, but we turn to God and realize that God, divine mind, is action. Then we begin to realize the Christ of it, and so we begin to see that the divine mind always manifests itself as divine action, that it translates itself to each situation as the divine action. The divine action which uncovers the belief of its opposite. And so we begin in our treatment to see that all the action there is the divine mind coming to every point of existence and uncovering and annihilating a false sense of action, the belief in stagnation, of overaction, of inaction, of irritated action, of unbalanced action, of irregular action, of whatever it is, of irritated action. So we have the Christ sense of it. We just see that the action of Christ is coming to every proposition and situation and uncovering and annihilating a false sense of action or function. Then we begin to realize the Christianity sense of it, namely the reflected sense of it, where we begin to see that therefore all that there is true about man is that man is always acting in God's way. That therefore the only truth there is about that patient is that man knows that he is divinely active, that man is conscious of it, of being active in a divine way, in a spiritual way, in a harmonious way, in a balanced way, in a loving way, and so on. And so you get the sense of man being the idea of action. And finally you turn to the fourth side and you begin to realize that there isn't anything in the reality but the action of being. That there are not the action of God and a false action of the body. That all that is ever going on is the one action. And that there is no other action but the action of God, which is omni-action. So you see, your thought really turns around the idea of mind as action. But it combines itself and blends itself with the four sides of the holy city, which is the modus operandi, really, of that idea. It's not enough just to have the revelation what is the truth about the governing error. We must also see how that truth operates within the divine infinite calculus. What is the modus operandi of this idea, namely the Word, the Christ, Christianity, and science, so that every idea reflects these four sides of the holy city. So we have considered here how an idea blends with the four. We can also take another blending, namely how the four sides of the holy city reflect each other, how the four reflects the four. That's why in the description really of the New Jerusalem in the Bible, one sees that these four sides of the holy city have three gates through which to enter. Each side reflects the other sides of the holy city. So, just as in mathematics, you can have operations of the four with the four. Say, we have operations where we multiply, say, divisions. A division, for instance, is a fraction, like, say, one-fourth. You can, therefore, take a division, like one-fourth, and multiply it, say, with another division, like three-fifths. And so you have a calculus there where where one of the four operations is combined with another one of the four operations. Here, multiplication with division. And in the same way, in being, as shown in the holy city, where each side is reflected by the other side through the gates in those four sides, we can blend the four with the four and get the 16, where the Word blends with the Word, with the Christ, with Christianity, and with science, where the Christ blends with the Word, with the Christ, with Christianity, and science. And so you get the 4 times 4. And that is, in mathematics, symbolized by a matrix. And Mrs. Eddy uses that term matrix in her textbook too, when she speaks that being has a matrix of immortality. That really our being operates within a divine, infinite matrix. For instance, the presentation of this 4 times 4 is something which the Bible has seen long before us. The Epistle of the Hebrews is one great exhibition of how the 4 blend with the 4. Everything is built up in the four times four. The world blending with the world, and the world blending with the Christ, and then with Christianity and with science. Then the subject changes and goes to the Christ, to the high priest, and shows it as the world, as the Christ, as Christianity and the science. Then it goes to a different subject, namely to the sanctuary, and shows that sanctuary, the realm of ideas, Christianity as the world, and then as the Christ, and Christianity and the science. And so goes on through the whole of Hebrews, one great presentation of that four times four and four times four. Just like, really, the textbook. The textbook of Christian Science has 16 chapters. And these 16 chapters are nothing else but an order of presentation of the world in its four aspects, and the Christ in its four aspects, and Christianity in its four aspects, and then science in its four aspects. And so, giving really the matrix of science. What means really matrix? It's a beautiful word. Matrix means, according to Webster, means a place or enveloping element within which something originates, takes form, or develops. You see, it shows it is an enveloping element. The textbook really is such a matrix. It envelops, so to say, 16 chapters. And within those 16 chapters happens what in a matrix happens, namely, therein something originates, then takes form or develops. The whole textbook, therefore, is one great development from the moment we have a true sense of prayer. Prayer is the approach to God. Matrix is also defined as that which gives form, origin, or foundation to something enclosed or embedded in it. So it gives a wonderful sense that if we have a consciousness of the matrix of immortality, as Mystic Lady calls it, that within that matrix of immortality we find the immortal development of our true being. That we find therein those elements which give form to our immortal status of manhood. So, up to now, you see, we have shown the various orders, the order of the seven, the order of the four, how these orders blend with each other, the seven with the seven with the four with the four, just showing how there is one infinite calculus. Now, the divine infinite principle not only expresses itself in order, but also through law and laws. It is quite interesting to see that Mrs. Eddy uses the term law and laws, the singular and the plural, indicating that God is a being that is lawful, so to say, that being is a great law, that it is not chaotic, that it is not chance, but that being is according to law. But she also uses in the positive this term in the plural, because this law expresses itself in its definite laws. So that we would have to ask really, what are these laws? You see, usually, when we ask a Christian Scientist, what are the laws of God, he usually would state some rules and not some laws. Mrs. Sidibet says, from the infinite one in Christian Science comes one principle and its infinite idea, and with this infinitude come spiritual rules, laws, and their demonstration. What really is a law? One of the dictionaries says it is a statement of an order or relation of phenomena which is invariable under the given condition. So an order really takes one of these infinite statements we have seen as either being a blending of the seven and the four, or the seven and the seven, and so on, takes one of these infinite statements and shows this infinite statement as something invariable under a given condition. That is, if we have a definite statement or standpoint in being, we can always see that this standpoint in being acts according to a law. And so, in Christian Science, we really should be interested in finding these laws, the fundamental laws. Just as in physics, or in chemistry, or in mathematics, we are not satisfied by saying that mathematics has law, or is a law, therefore invariable. We want to go further and say, what are these laws? Why is it a law? What are the ideas of these laws? In which way does this law express itself in various individual laws? And so, more and more, the interest shifts now to see how an infinite statement is governing reality in a law-abiding and law-fulfilling way. I don't want to go any further into this. I just want to pinpoint that the Bible and the textbook really symbolize these various laws, which are always fundamental, and therefore fundamental not only to the biblical writers, but for today too. I have tried to point out the fundamental laws in two of my books, namely in The Minor Prophets, in the Light of Christian Science, where I tried to show the various laws of the Christ. Then, in another book, The Epistles, in the Light of Christian Science, I try to show the laws of Christianity, showing the fundamental laws of Christianity. And the main interest of these two books is not so much on a interpretation of the biblical text, but much more in the distilling out of the biblical text and the illustration the underlying divine eternal law, those laws which are applicable in every age and not just restricted to a specific circumstance, because a law is always universal. Now, I have spoken to you about this calculus, the blendings, about the laws, about the orders, about the matrix. And as I said, I only wanted to hint what really is the field of investigation when we go on in the study of Christian Science. Just as the beginner in arithmetic is first trained in the numeration table, so we too really have first to be trained in that numeration table of Christian Science. You see, the child that goes to school for the first year is not so much interested in first having to apply his knowledge in practical life. He's first taught the principle of arithmetic. Then when he is trained in that principle and is well drilled in the numeration table, then for him it will be easy to go out into life and to be able to calculate what he has to calculate that which experience and life experience presents to him. So let us be therefore aware that if we want to investigate Christian Science as a science, that we really begin to realize that our heart must first belong to the science of Christian Science before we can then apply it as Christianity. Mrs. Eddy was well aware of this. She speaks quite a bit and quite often about the numeration table of Christian Science. In her message to the Mother Church in 1901, she says, "I begin at the feet of Christ and with the numeration table of Christian Science." She says, "That's where I begin. But I do not say that one added to one is three or one and a half, nor say this to accommodate popular opinion as to the signs of Christianity." He says, "I'm not interested to state any old truth or any nice statement that pleases people." She says, "What I'm interested is to first add one to one, and then two to another one, and to go to the three, and add another one to the four." Just as in our study, really, we should start with that sense, let us first see what is God as mind, then add to it what is God as spirit, then add to it what is God as soul, and then add to it what is God as principle. Though we may not be able yet to do much with it, but when we study a subject scientifically, we have that humility and greatness to first devote our heart to the truth for truth's sake, and not for the sake of the loaves and the fishes. She goes on in that article and says, "I adhere to my text that one and one are two all the way up to the infinite calculus of the infinite God." You see how wonderful she said. She says, "I'm like a child. I begin to add one and one, that they are two, and go on that way up to the infinite calculus of the infinite God." This is really what a true schooling, what a true teaching should do. But naturally it can only be done when the system of Christian Science, the science of Christian Science, is being understood. Before, we cannot do that. Before that, we just will teach hundreds or thousands of isolated truths. She goes on and says, "The numeration table of Christian Science, its divine principle and rules, are before the people." She put it right before the people through her textbook. "Are right before the people and the different religious sects." Oh, sorry, I didn't put it right. "The numeration table of Christian Science, its divine principle and rules, are before the people. And the different religious sects and the differing schools of medicine discuss them as if they understood its principle and rules before they have learned its numeration table." And that's what happens, you see. People discuss, be it the sects, be it medicine, be it theology, be it the great number of Christian scientists, they discuss the Christian Science textbook and the principle of Christian Science before they have learned its numeration table, and therefore can never discuss it properly. Only then, when we have learned this so-called numeration table of Christian Science, when we have learned the fundamentals of Christian Science, the seven and the four, and how they blend, how the seven blend with the seven, how the seven blend with the four, how the four blend with the four. Only in that measure we have touched the numeration table of Christian Science. And only then can we intelligently discuss the principle of Christian Science. So you see that the use of such a systematic teaching and schooling is really to culture within us a scientific divine consciousness. That's what is first necessary. Just as for the schoolboy or schoolgirl, the teacher first cultures within the student a cultured scientific consciousness of that subject. And so, therefore, the use of this teaching should first be to get a divinely scientific consciousness. Just that, what Mrs. Eddy said, that thought accepts the divine infinite calculus. Only then we know in every branch of science, when we have that scientific consciousness, we can apply it truly to the everyday problem, to that which is erroneous. But the divine problem, the first problem is the divine problem. The divine problem is to culture and receive such a scientific divine consciousness. A problem is not always something negative, but can something be very positive. Up to now, I was always talking about a problem, as we use it in the slogan of Christian Science, as an erroneous situation. But clearly, in every science, a problem is always a statement of something which is true. You have in mathematics given to you by the teacher a problem. That problem is not erroneous, it's divine. But it is a problem because we do not yet know exactly its scientific content and solution. But it isn't erroneous. And so really our very first problem is a divine problem, namely where we ask ourselves what constitutes a divinely scientific consciousness. So often when we present this idea to the student may ask here a question, and he says, but when I have to meet a disharmonious situation, a so-called erroneous problem, do I then have to go through all that? Do I have to go first through all the synonymous terms, and then through the blending of them, and then through the four, and then through the blending of the four? Oh no. Just as when you have, say, to calculate in arithmetic, what is 316, say, multiplied by 2,185, you are not going first through the whole numeration table. But your consciousness is so trained in arithmetic that you know exactly this is a multiplication, therefore I have to use the law of multiplication, and you know when you have numbers of so, which is so many digits and so on, you have to use this and this rule to solve it. So you just can do the right thing. And you don't have first to go through the numeration table and say, well, first I must know something all about multiplication. What is 1 multiplied by 1? What 1 multiplied by 2? 1 multiplied by 3? 1 multiplied by 4? So, you see. So let's be clear, you see, that we have, so to say, two big fields in front of us. The one big field is the divine problem, namely to culture within us that divine infinite calculus, so that our consciousness accepts the divine infinite calculus. Then we have as a second and secondary field how to apply it to so-called erroneous problems, which one has to solve. And that is just to use that divine scientific consciousness specifically and directly to that problem. Well, really, that would bring me to to a great question, namely, that really, the in Christian Science, we really should distinguish between the preventive and curative art of Christian Science. Here, when we are considering the scientific nature of Christian Science, we really are more interested in the preventive art of Christian Science, namely, in that art which establishes within us such a consciousness which is not subject to suggestions anymore, which is, so to say, immune against false influences and false beliefs, and therefore is not anymore in danger of losing its scientific consciousness and standard, and so get into trouble. Mrs. Eddy said, the prophylactic and therapeutic, that is, the preventive and curative arts, belong emphatically to Christian Science. It is just like Jesus telling his disciples that really the beauty and grandeur of Christian Science should not be the curative art, but the preventive art. He would say to his disciples, notwithstanding, in this rejoice not, that the spirits are subject unto you, but really the devils are subject unto you. In this, he says, don't rejoice so much, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven. Just rejoice more and more that our consciousness is scientifically imbued with God. So therein lies our great joy and the great aim. So we do well if we study Christian Science not for the sake of the loaves and fishes, but that we study Christian Science for the sake that our names are written in heaven, which means always name is just a symbol for identity, that we are identified with God, that we are at one with the divine infinite calculus. You see, in the chapter on Revelation, on Apocalypse, in the Christian Science textbook which deals with the chapter, with the book on Revelation, Mrs. Eddy makes also this distinction between latent error and visible error. She says, did this same book contain the revelation of divine science, meaning naturally the Christian Science textbook, the right foot, or dominant power of which, the right foot, that which has the dominant power, the right foot or dominant power of which was upon the sea, upon elementary, latent error, the source of all error's visible forms, whereas the angel's left foot was upon the earth, the sea, that which has already taken form, was upon the earth, that is, a secondary power was exercised upon visible error and audible sin. Here we really have, again, in another way, the distinction between the preventive and curative art of Christian Science, showing that really the main thing would be the right foot, the dominant power, which is on latent error, not on error that has already taken form as disease, as lack, or as anything like that, but which deals with latent error, the source of error's visible form, which deals, so to say, with ignorance, with misunderstanding, with the unwillingness to accept God in its science. So really, when we culture our consciousness in the divine infinite calculus, then we really exercise that dominant power. Then we stand on the right foot. Then we deal with elementary latent error, we deal with the ignorance about God. Whereas the practice of Christian Science in healing disease is really secondary. The angel's left foot, she said, is the secondary power which deals with visible error and audible sins.